Hello, everyone. My name is Bob Frey. I'm a grateful recovering member of the Worldwide Fellowship of the Al-Anon Family Groups.
Hi, Bob.
First, I want to thank Renee for inviting me and my wife to this lovely place, and for the committee for asking us. And I also want to thank Bob D. for picking us up, and we had a delightful time driving up here. Although coming up through the desert, I just recently finished reading Stephen King's Desperation, and I expected the mad cop to stop us somewhere along the line. We got through that. But I enjoyed the opportunity of just sharing with Bob coming up. We had met him several years ago, and that's one of the privileges that we have in speaking around the country, that we get to meet wonderful people, and you know, we're all part of a big family, and alcoholism is a family illness. And these people around the country that we've come to know, they're just part of our family. And so this weekend we get to meet more of our family. I was also thinking, coming through the hotel there's a little lounge back there in the corner, and I was thinking of a story of a fellow went into a lounge like that and ordered a drink, and there was no one else in there, and he had this drink, and all of a sudden he heard this voice that said, "Say, man, that's a great tie you have on." And he looked around, and there was no one there. So he sat there, and he thought about that for a minute, and then he heard a voice saying, "That's a great shirt you got on. It just picks up the colors on that tie. It's great." So the fellow really started getting suspicious, and he called the bartender over, and he said, told him he'd been hearing these voices, and the bartender just sort of laughed. He says, "Oh, it's in the peanuts. They're complimentary." So, now that we're awake. Well, we could tell jokes for a while, but I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. And I'd like to start off with, you know, someone once asked Lois Wilson, one of the founders of Al-Anon, what she did when, you know, we start our meetings with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. And someone asked her once, what did she do in that moment of silence? And she said, "Well, I invite God to come into our meeting." And that's what I'd like to do. If you will, take a moment. We'll have a moment of silence here. And let's invite God into this meeting. Now, if you don't have a God, you can use mine. I think he's big enough to take care of that. And so I'd like to just take a moment here of silence and let's invite the God of our understanding into this meeting. Thank you. I guess they say the boy is father of the man, so my story starts as a boy growing up in a small town in Michigan. I'm not a native of Louisville, although my relatives accuse me of talking Southern at times. I don't know what that is. But as growing up as a boy, I was the youngest in a family of four. I suppose, and I hate to use a word, but I suppose that that family would be called dysfunctional. And it was, as I look back on it, it was kind of weird. My father was a functional illiterate. He couldn't read or write. And my mother had 1 year of college. Now, how they ever got together was a family secret. You know, we talk about secrets, and the secrets will keep us sick. And that was a big secret in our family. The message that I got was they didn't talk about it. We did know that they were both married in a previous life, but they didn't talk about that either. And the message I got was that your divorce was bad and all that, and so I ended up I've been married three times to three alcoholics, so you might say I have a perfect record. So, you know, we say we're attracted to alcoholics. Yeah, when we see them, we just got to marry them, take care of them. Coming into the meetings, you know, especially if it's an alcoholic NAA convention, I sometimes have an identity crisis because I think I should sometime introduce myself by saying, my name is Bob Frey, and through the grace of this program and good sponsorship and meetings and people like you, I haven't found it necessary to manage, manipulate, or control since Easter Sunday of 1983. And that will tell you my obsession. My obsession is to manage, manipulate, and control. At an early age, I tried that. As I said, I grew up in this family in Michigan, and one of the things nobody told me they loved me, and it was, I'm sure they did, but I was ashamed of my father, because he couldn't read or write, and he was very profane. He wasn't obscene, he was profane. Today I understand that he was probably frustrated, and that was the only way he could express himself. Fortunately for this program, I was able, when I did some amends, is to go to my father's graveside, because he died before I found this program. And I was able to make some amends there and tell him that I loved him, and that I knew today, that I know today, that he did the best he could with what he had. And that is what I believe that this program asks for of us, is to do the best we can with what we have at that particular moment. Well, growing up like that, one of the things that happened is that there was no affection shown. And I thought since there were four of us, there should have been some affection, you would have thought, but I've been told that you don't need that to procreate. But in any event, I used to go into a neighbor's house, and the father would come home, and he'd give his wife a hug, and I was embarrassed because there was no hugging in my home. And I thought that was something that was reserved for the bedroom. I wanted to be a good son, and I got in at an early age. I tried to be the peacemaker. In the early age, my two brothers went off to the service. It was the Second World War, and I was a teenager, and so I never went into the service, and my two brothers were gone, and we lived in a small town, and we lived right next to the Methodist Church, and my family got their rent free for the house we lived in return for doing the janitorial work in the church. And I would go over there on Saturday and clean the church with my mother, and then I would do the firing. They had an old hot water heating unit, and I would stoke it up about 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd get that thing roaring, and I'd walk through that church in the early morning, and it would be dark. For a 13-year-old, 14-year-old, whatever I was, that's kind of spooky. And I would come to the altar, that church, and there was a little light there, and I'd get down on my knees and I'd pray, and I'd say, God, what do you want me to do with my life? And I didn't get any burning bushes or Pauline lights, and so the message that I got is I had to take care of myself. And somewhere along the line they told me that God helps those who help themselves. And I don't believe that today. I believe that God helps those who ask. And that's one of the big problems we have, especially as males in Al-Anon, is to ask for the help we need. We think we're self-sufficient, and that self-sufficiency will kill us. And that's one of the problems that I had in my life. I was told that I could do anything I wanted to do. And until I bumped my head up against the wall of alcoholism, I pretty much thought that I could do anything I wanted to do. And growing up, I was an overachiever. I was a good student. Got into high school, and I was a Boy Scout, I was an Eagle Scout, I did well academically, and I sort of pushed that aside and hid it, because I didn't want the reputation of being stuck up or something, so I like to hang around with the kids who were out having fun. And that meant going drinking beer and everything else. And since I had a receding hairline at the time, they would get me to go buy the beer. And I'd walk into the liquor store and I'd put my head down because I had a sort of receding hairline. It's all receded now, as you notice. By the way, that's not a bald head. That's a solar panel for a sex machine. So I like to run around with these kids, and I like they were living on the edge, and I would go buy the beer for them, and then if they got drunk, I would take them home and make excuses for them, and I was practicing my Al-Anonism at an early age. No, the alcoholic sort of lives on the edge, and sometimes I think that our job is to keep them from falling over the edge. We love to live on the edge. We love the excitement. I love the excitement. You who have been in Al-Anon for any number of times will know the number of meetings you talk about the excitement of living with an alcoholic. And the only problem is that we try to keep them from falling over that edge, whether they want to fall over or not. They just don't seem to give a damn, but we want to keep them from falling over the edge, and we do this under the guise of helping them. And all of the things that we do it under the guise of good works, that we're doing good things. And in those early years, I learned that if I was dating, I would be more apt to tell the young lady, not that I loved her, but that I needed to take care of her. And to me, that was more important than love. I guess it meant the same thing. And so, you know, there's a lot of people out there, both alcoholics and non-alcoholics, who want to be taken care of. And that's right up our alley. The only problem is that we don't take care of, we capture. And we tell those people that if you just do what I tell you to do, you'll be okay. Regardless of what they want to do, you know, we say, just do what I'm doing and do what I want you to do here and you'll be okay. Well, I've come to understand that's the nature of conditional love, and it took me a long time before I got to the point of knowing what that is, true love is, or unconditional love is. But that excitement that we find with being around alcoholics, I found that even in high school, that the kids that were drinking and carrying on, I loved to be with them. Boy, that was exciting. I was thinking about it this morning when Marianne was talking about the eyes, you know. I sponsor a fellow who says, he said, I love to be around alcoholic women. He said, you just look in their eyes, and you can tell. If you're with a group of people, you can tell the alcoholic women because you just look in their eyes, and those eyes just say, take care of me. And this is what this fellow was saying all the time. He said, oh, I just love to be with alcoholic women. We were at an assembly one time, and I was sitting at a table with about 8 black belt Al-Anon women, and this sponsee and myself, and he was spouting off about the eye stuff, and he turned to these women, he said, no offense meant, ladies, but he said, you know, the women in Al-Anon just don't turn me on. He says, it's those alcoholics, he says, they turn me on. And one of the ladies turned to him and said, Sonny, she does the same thing for us. So I guess it runs, it's a cross-gender thing. But in those early years, it was in high school, and as I said, I was ashamed of my father, and I wanted to get out of high school and get into college, and so I got off to college, and I did the same things in college that I was doing in high school. I was an overachiever. I did all of the things that we do in being overachievers, but I did those not so much for me. I did those things because I wanted your acceptance. I wanted to be accepted, and I didn't know how to do it. I was scared to death most of the time, and we talk about comparing our inside to the others, to the exterior, and that's pretty much what I was doing, because inside I was scared to death. I was lonely. You get lonely in a crowd, you feel less than, and all of the things that we do to ourselves with, I don't think any of us come in here with high self-esteem. But I got into college, and after about 3 or 4 years, I was in college, and I thought that I ought to have a girlfriend. You know, that's the American dream is to do this. And so I went into the student center one day, and they needed a fourth for a bridge, and so I sat down, and this was the way I met my first wife. She was skipping school and skipping class and was playing bridge and just having a good time, but she was flunking out of school. And I started dating her, and so I took her under my wing and taught her how to study and do all of the things that she needed to do to be okay. And that made me okay because I was taking care of someone. And when you're taking care of someone, you don't have to look at yourself. And so I took care of her, and after she got, I graduated, I was a senior, she was a freshman, and I graduated from college and went off to law school, and she finished school and did quite well, and when she got through, we went off to Chicago, and we got married. And that was the American dream. We were going to get married and live happily ever after, live in the cottage with a rose trellis on the side and have our 2.2 children and live happily ever after. Well, that first lady that I married was a closet alcoholic, and I didn't know anything about closet alcoholic. I never really saw her drink heavily, although in her early years when we got married, I used to come home from work, and she'd have a martini there for me, and I thought that was kind of nice, and she'd give me a drink, and we'd have dinner. In the middle of dinner, she'd fall asleep in her dinner. And I couldn't understand why she was tired, but I thought, well, she just worked hard all day, and that she was tired. And eventually we had two little girls, and my wife at that time had problems. I knew she had problems, but in those days, if you had problems, you went to the psychiatrist. They didn't have treatment centers, and I didn't really know she had a problem with drinking until many years later. I just thought she did a lot of weird things, and so she'd go talk to her psychiatrist, and when she came back to the psychiatrist, I'd say, well, what do you talk about at the psychiatrist? And she'd say, we talk about things, and I said, she said, if you're interested, call him up, ask him. I didn't want to call him up. I was afraid he might tell me there's something wrong with me, and I knew there wasn't anything wrong with me. And so that's the way our life went along, and we left, we were in Chicago, and then we moved to Cincinnati, and I thought things would get better. I took a different job. I sort of took a geographical cure, and things didn't get any better, and to make a long story short, we moved from there to Louisville, and but she didn't make the move to Louisville. She went home to live with her mother. Both of those, my first two wives, I would like to say I threw them out, but my ego would like to say that. But the truth is that they left me. Now, we have this fear of abandonment, and when we're in a relationship, no matter how bad it is, we think we can fix it. And that's the way if those women had not left me, I'd still been there trying to fix it. And of all the things that happened in my life, my ego, and this happens to the male ego more so, I believe, that we, from the beginning, our society tells us that to be strong, and to be a good father, a good husband, you got to be able to take care of these things. And so it's humiliating when you can't take care of these things. And when I first came up against alcoholism, I didn't know what I was facing. I've come to understand that it's a threefold disease, spiritual, physical, and mental, but I didn't know. I just thought that I could fix it because I felt that I could fix anything. Well, she left, and I'm living in Louisville with two little girls, and I kept the girls. She went off to her mother, and she said, just give me some money to see my psychiatrist. She said, I'm not fit to be a wife or a mother. So for 16 years, she didn't make any contact with those girls. She didn't even write them a Christmas card. And today, as I look back on that, I was probably fortunate because I didn't have to, I wrote, I, for better or worse, I didn't have anybody telling me how to raise those girls. And they, fortunately, after both, until those daughters got married and were out of my home, their mother did make no contact with them. But she did reach out, or they reached out, and they had a relationship, whatever it was. It was not part of me, and that's okay. I was not a part of that. And just 2 months ago, that their mother died. And those two girls went down to their, when their mother was sick, and she was very sick, and they knew that they had to put her on a respirator or she's going to die. Well, one of the, my oldest daughter's a nurse, and she said, no, let her die. And the other one said that was God's choice, not theirs. So they called me up to ask me what they should do. And I felt good that they looked, turned to me, but I also said that, I really had no, I couldn't solve that problem for them. And it was okay. I felt okay with that, that they could have their own relationship with their mother, and they went through the experience of death and taking care of all of that, and they're grieving. And it was okay. But in those, as I said, in we were living alone there. I was having housekeepers, and someone told me to put an ad in the newspaper, and they said, you can get a full-time housekeeper. So I got a full-time housekeeper by putting an ad in the newspaper. And maybe 30 women answered that ad. And so with my two daughters and myself, we had interviews, and we hired one woman to be our housekeeper. She had a little girl with her. She said that her husband was an alcoholic and that he had beaten her up the night before, and she'd escaped with just clothes on her back and a little bag of clothes for the little girl, who was 6 years old at the time. Well, we figured, we had this family conference, and I had all these girls' clothes that we could dress the little girl, and so we hired this woman to be our housekeeper. Within a week, we're playing house, and so we lived together for about a year. And I was in the middle of getting a divorce, and she was in the middle of getting her divorce. But we told our children that we were married, and so we carried on that kind of a relationship for the better part of a year. And finally, when both of our divorces came through, we eloped to Indiana across the river and got married. That lady said she never had a alcohol problem until she met me. I'm sure none of you have ever heard that. But we're pretty sick. I was thinking we got some newcomers here, and I'd like to tell the newcomers that, you know, you're sicker than the alcoholics in your families. Now, I have friends that tell me that I shouldn't tell newcomers that, but that's the truth, because the things we do cold sober. And we can't point the finger of alcoholism. In fact, I have a friend who works in a treatment center, and he says half the time when they bring in a drunk, it's hard to tell who's a drunk and who's a family member. He says usually the family member is screeching and yelling and carrying on, and the drunk just sitting there says, oh, well. Nothing bothers them, because we have to worry about that. See, we have to worry about them, so they don't have to do that. Well, with this lady, a lot of crazy things happened, and I don't mean to take her inventory, but just to tell you some of those stories, just to show you how sick I was. There were a lot of crazy things happened. One of the things she thought she ought to have is a gun, and she thought she needed a gun to protect herself, and so she bought this gun. And one night we're sitting on our sofa in our family room, and she's cleaning it, and she's doing all these things, and I'm sitting next to her trying to tell her in my own logical and mimical way that why she didn't need this gun. And she put the gun to my head and she said, shut up. Talk about spiritual awakenings. So Unbeknownst to me, she pointed to the ceiling, but she pulled the trigger and it went off, and I wet my pants. And about a year later, I found that gun, and I took the gun and the ammunition, and I went down to the Ohio River, and I threw the gun in the river. And I felt so relieved, and I came back, and I told somebody about that, and I told them what I had done, and they said to me, "Well, what took you a year to, why did it take you a year to do that?" I said, "Well, I don't want to hurt her feelings." And that's the way we are. We don't want to rock the boat, and we don't want, we expect them to, we don't want to hurt anybody's feelings, but we don't want to tell them how we feel. And alcoholism is a disease of frozen feelings. So I don't even know if we knew how we felt, how we could tell them how we felt. But in any event, we didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. We don't want to rock the boat. We just want to we want to persevere, and we want to take care of everything. We want everybody to be happy. And another thing this lady did, She was a nurse, and she worked in treatment centers. I went to my first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with her because she had some of her clients, and she asked me to go along to a AA meeting. And I went to my first meeting, and all I can remember from that meeting was a lot of smoke and a lot of coffee. They still have the coffee, but hopefully the smoke is dissipating. But there was a woman spoke at that evening. She was down from Fort Knox, which adjoins Louisville. And she was telling her story, and she was telling about these feelings, and I related to a lot of the things that she said. And it was sort of kind of scary to me because she was saying things that I could relate to. And even though, you know, when we talk about the disease of alcoholism, and we talk about our program in Al-Anon and AA, you know, it's the same disease and it's the same program. And we have to stay... The basis of the whole program is that we have to stay attached to a higher power. We have to stay in a good place. We have to stay connected. And when we have all the things that we have, resentments, anger, jealousy, all of those things are things that separate, at least me, they separate me from my higher power. And they separate me from the serenity that we talk about in this program. AA talks about sobriety. I think in Al-Anon, we don't talk about sobriety, we talk about serenity, and we had a serenity countdown. Because that is, we can lose our serenity in a moment, the same way the alcoholic can lose his sobriety in a moment. All it takes is a little moment, a little slip. The only thing with our slips, you can't smell them. Where the alcoholic has a slip, you can smell it. With us, maybe our action smells, but we can't smell it. But anyway, in living with this lady, she also said to me one day we were talking about the right to die. And so she said that we were sitting, she was upstairs drinking in her room, and I went downstairs and I was doing some things and I came back, and she had this mason jar full of all kinds of pills. She worked in the various places she worked as a nurse, she would take pills, and she'd bring them home, and she had a whole mason jar full of them. So I went upstairs, and the mason jar of pills was empty, and she says, "Well, I've done it." And I said, "Done what?" She says, "Well, I've taken my life." And I went to the telephone, I called EMS, and she says, "No, remember we talked about this, and you said that you had the right, that we should all have a right to die." And I looked at her, and I thought, well, maybe God's answering my prayers. And I looked at her, and her eyes started getting glassy, and her speech became slurred. She laid down on the bed, went to sleep, and I said, "Well, maybe this is all the way it's going to happen." And I laid down on the bed next to her, and I started writing her obituary. And I wrote her obituary, and I decided I picked her coffin out, and I thought about what I was going to tell the various members of the family and how I was going to dress her and all this stuff, and I went to sleep. And I felt very much at peace. And that's cold sober. And I woke up after half hour or so, and I realized the insanity of this whole thing. And I got her up, and she was, thank God she was still breathing, and I got a coffee into her, and we had her stomach pumped out, and she was okay. And, you know, you look back at that story, and the thing that really frightens me is how logical I thought that was at one time. And it was pure insanity, and that's the nature of this illness, the insanity. Well, things, we went along, well, in that first marriage, I had been married 13 years, and also in my second marriage, I've been, was married about 13 years. And in my present marriage, I'm coming up on 12, and my wife tells me that she won't feel comfortable until we get by 13. So, and I'm getting better too, because I'm marrying recovering alcoholics now. But this wife finally, she came to me and she said that she was working in the juvenile treatment center in Louisville, and she said she had this I had this stepdaughter, and she was 16 years old, and she said, well, before I go into that part of the story, there's two things that I need to talk about that I don't like to talk about. That's why I almost passed those on. There's two things that happened in that marriage that I don't like to talk about, because it really hurts me. They involved my... There was two things. First thing was with my daughters. I had these two daughters, and she told me, this wife told me, she says, you have to make a choice. It's either me or them. Well, I love my daughters. But she says, you either got to stay with me or you've got to get rid of these girls. And so I said, okay, what do I got to do? At that time, the one daughter had just... she had graduated from high school, and she knew this was going on, and so she said, I'm going to join the Army. And so she joined the Army, and she's a nurse today, but I can still see her trudging up to with her little overnight bag. She's trudging up those steps to the Federal Building in Louisville to go into the Army, and she was running, and today she's a member of AA, and has been for some 3 or 4 years, and has blessed us with two granddaughters. One's 10, the other's 12, and they probably be a candidate for one of our programs one of these years. And the other daughter was younger, and she got off to college, and I tried to protect her by not bringing her home. So she stayed in Michigan and lived with my sister for a while, but I didn't bring her home. And this, today I feel very, when I talk about this, I feel very badly because of that situation. I've tried to make amends to both of these girls, and they don't really know what I'm talking about sometimes, but they've told me that, my oldest daughter told me, she says, I don't know what you're talking about, Dad, but the biggest demand that you can do for us is to continue to live like you're living today. Because she said, I see the way you live today, and that's the biggest demand that you can make for us. And my second daughter, she is a professor, she's a PhD, she is a marine biology, and when Marcia was talking about going to Auburn, that made me think of her because she is a professor at Auburn University. Both her and her husband are professors there. And when a couple of years ago, when she was in Boston at the time, and she called me up and she said, I'd like to make a proposition, Dad. She says, how would you like to come up and babysit your grandsons? Well, at that time, she had two sons, and one was about 6, and the other one was about 4. And she said, how would you like to come up and babysit them? She says, both her and her husband was going down to Auburn to interview for this job, and she said, I don't trust anybody here in Boston, and would you come and babysit? So Camille, my wife, said, well, she couldn't go, but I went alone. So I babysat them for a week in Boston. That was quite an experience. They loved to ride the subway, so we were riding subways every day. But on Sunday, my daughter had made me a list of things, being her father's daughter, she had this list of things for me to do, and one of them was to take the boys to Sunday school on Sunday, and I went and took them to Sunday school. I found it, and I took them and took them to their class, and then I went into the sanctuary, and I sat down. And when I sat down there, all of the loneliness and pain of my life went back 25 years, because that's what I used to do with my daughters when they were little. I would take them to Sunday school, and then I would go sit alone in a church. And I started crying. I felt all that pain, but that those tears only lasted about 30 seconds, because I said, I'm not in that place anymore. I don't have to go to that place anymore. I have a program that takes me out of that type of feeling. I never want to forget the pain of those days, but I know that with my program, as we say, pain is inevitable, but misery is optional. And I recognized very quickly that I don't have to be miserable, and so it stopped right then, and I felt okay. And today I think those girls are okay, but that was one of the things that I'm not very proud of. And the other thing that happened in that relationship is I don't like to talk about it, is because it affects my ego. She started having affairs. She started running around. You know, we have this double standard in our society, and it's all right, at least in some respects. A lot of my male friends say it's all right for them to do that, but it's not all right for their wives to do that. And I think it works both ways. But she started having affairs, and then she'd come back, she'd have an affair, and she'd come back and tell me about it. And the first time she told me that, I put my fist through a wall. And my first inclination was to throw her out. Well, then I started thinking about that, and I said to myself, well, there's something wrong with me. Because if I was a better husband, a better father, a better lover, a better anything, she wouldn't have to do that. And so I felt I was responsible for that. And I've come to understand that I'm not responsible for another human being. The only person I'm responsible for is myself. But in those days, I felt that I was responsible for all of that. And today I understand that she was doing what she needed to do to take care of herself, and it had nothing to do with me. But I stayed on and tried to fix that relationship. Well, she came to me, she was working before that, I felt the way to fix that running around, she had a girlfriend. And so I went out and propositioned her girlfriend. I was going to take a business trip to New York, and I took the girlfriend along with me and seduced her. And I got home, and as fast as I could, I ran home and I told my wife where I'd been, what I'd done. Things didn't get any better. So if any of you out there got ideas like that, don't. And it was mentioned this morning about doing amends, you know, when you make those amends. If you're out there sleeping with somebody else's wife or husband, as the case may be, stop it. And don't do it anymore. When we do our amends in that seventh and eighth step, one of the things that we don't emphasize enough, you know, when it says amends means that, just amending our life, doing something different. If I step on your toe and say I'm sorry, if I come right back and step on it again, you must say, that guy's nuts. And that's what we sometimes do when we make these amends. It's about change. This program's about change, so we have to make those changes. Well, that, as I said, that didn't work, so the next thing is that she said that this daughter of hers needed to go to treatment. And since she worked in a juvenile treatment center there in Louisville, she decided that the child should go to a treatment center in Chattanooga. So we took her down there and enrolled her in a treatment center in Chattanooga. And then we came back, and she was talking to the daughter on the phone quite a bit, and after a couple of weeks of that, the stepdaughter down there confronted her and said that she needed to do something about her drinking and drugging. And so this wife said to me, she said, I'm going to treatment. She says, I got an alcohol and drug problem. I'm going to treatment. I'm going down to Chattanooga. So I put her on an airplane. She went down there. And then she was down there for 2 or 3 weeks. And her daughter was with her down there. And I went down there on Easter Sunday. for family week. And I got there and was there about a day, and a counselor and her confronted me, and she said to me, she said, "You're an alcoholic. You got to go to treatment. If you don't go to treatment, we're all through." Well, being a good codependent, I said, "Well, if that's what it takes to get you sober, I'll go to treatment." So I called my boss up and I said, "Well, they tell me I'm an alcoholic." He said, "Well, I didn't know you had that problem." I said, "Well, I didn't know I had that problem either." But, so I signed up and I told him I was an alcoholic. And so we'd been there a week or so, and she booked in the middle of the night. I had driven down there, and she had keys, and she just disappeared. And my counselor said to me, he thought first that I had connived with her, and I hadn't talked to her in a few days. And so he said to me, he said, "I don't know if you're an alcoholic or not, but," he said, "I'll tell you one thing." And he said, "I don't like to tell you this, but," he says, "until you do something about this obsession that you have for this woman, you're never going to get well." And that's what we do. You know, we have this obsession, not to alcohol, but to the alcoholic. And it's just as sick, but it's an obsession. And so I signed up, and he said to me, "You're going to have to make a decision here. She's going to call you, and she wants you to leave. And you got to make a decision what you want to do." And so the first time she called, I was scared to death. And I didn't take the telephone call. And the next time she called, I took the call, and she says, "You got to get out of that place." She says, "You're not an alcoholic. They'll just screw your mind up." And she says, "You got to leave." She says, "I'll come and get you. And if you don't leave, we're all through." And I said, "Well, wait a minute. First you told me I'm an alcoholic, and if I don't go into treatment, we're all through. And now you're telling me I'm not an alcoholic. If I don't leave, we're all through." And she says, "Right." And for the first time in my life, I said no. You know, I often say I'm glad I'm not a woman. I've been pregnant all the time because I don't know how to say no. And so I said no. I said, "I'm going to stay here." And she said, "Well, we're all through." And I said, "Well, okay, but I'm going to stay here because I'm going to take care of myself." And I was scared to death. And I didn't know how this was going to come out, but I knew I just had to stay in this place. And I did stay 5 weeks, and I told him I was an alcoholic, and I was not a dummy. I knew my insurance wouldn't pay for it unless I told him I was an alcoholic. And I've had to come to grips with this, because this is an honest program, but I come to the realization after thinking about it, you know, I did get treatment for alcoholism. And it's a disease that affects both the drinker and the non-drinker. And I learned a lot about me and a lot about the disease of alcoholism, and I truly believe that I had treatment for alcoholism. So after 5 weeks, I got out of that place and I went home. And when I got home, she had moved out into an apartment, but since I was fixed and I was well now, I moved her back home. And I told her there's going to be a few changes, but that, and she was going to AA, I knew when I was in treatment that where I belonged was in Al-Anon. I went in treatment, we had gone to some AA meetings, and I saw those Al-Anon meetings going on. I knew where I belonged. So as soon as I got out of the treatment center, I started going to Al-Anon, and I went every day. In treatment, they talked about the alcoholic should go to 60 meetings in 60 days, and I said, "Well, that's what I'll do." And so that's what I did. And I went to a lot of Al-Anon meetings. And after about 4 or 5 months of this, wife, she just up and left me and filed for divorce. There has been some changes, I guess, were going on. But she left me. As I said earlier, both my wives left me. But I was in the program, and I had done what the program told me to do. I had a sponsor, the same sponsor I have today, some 16 years later. I have the same sponsor, but I did get a sponsor, and I went to a lot of meetings, and he told me to get into service, and I did that. I became the GR, and then later I did more service work. And he told me, he said, stay away from the women. He says, you don't need a woman to make you okay. And one is a full number. And if you're here and you think that you need a he or her in your life to make you whole, that's not true. It's nice to have a warm body next to you in bed at night. And I love my wife. She's my best friend. But I know that she can't fix me and she can't make me whole. That's my job. Well, after 2 years of that, my sponsor, one of the things he told me, it was 1985 convention, the first annual convention of Al-Anon, and was coming up, meeting with AA in Montreal. And he said, you need to sign up for something, volunteer for a workshop, go up there and do something. So when the time came, I did sign up, and when the time came, if I hadn't had that commitment, I probably wouldn't have gone. But I got on an airplane that day, and it was a storming in the Midwest, and flights were all screwed up, so I ended up going to Philadelphia and then to Boston. And I got on an airplane in Boston, and I don't know the name of the airline, what it was. I haven't heard of it before or since. I just call it God's airline. And I got on that airline. There weren't many people on that. It was a big plane, but there weren't many people on it. But there was a young lady sitting next to me, and she had her knee in a walking cast. And I started talking to her, and I said, where are you going? And she said, to Montreal. I said, well, I'm going to Montreal. I said, what are you going to Montreal for? And she said, convention. I said, AA or Al-Anon? And she says, AA. And I said, well, I'm one of the others. And we talked some more, and it turned out she's going to the same hotel I'm going to. And I said, well, it's right up my alley. I said, I'll get you through customs, and we'll get a wheelchair, and you can't walk. And I said, we'll get your bags, and we'll, I'm just organizing things, you know. As I say, you know, going back, manage, manipulating, and controlling. And we do that because it makes us comfortable. We fear if we're not in the control. And that's where if you really work on the steps, and if you're really doing 1, 2, and 3, and you really are accepting the fact that you're powerless, and accepting the fact of a higher power, and turning your life and your will over to God, you'll be okay. You don't have that fear. The fear will go away. But until then, you're going to manage, manipulate, and control. And that's what I was doing. So we got her bags and got the cab, and I went downtown, took her down there, and she was staying with about 10 or 12 women from Denver, and she was in the penthouse right above me, and I was on the floor right below. So I threw my bag into my room, and she had about 5 bags, and I went up. She said she always, I asked her, what is she doing all those bags? And she said, oh, I like choices. So I took her up to where she was staying, and all these women were, you know how alcoholic women are, they're just running around the dead, they're all over. I said, what's the problem? I'll take care of this. What's going on here? Well, it turned out that they didn't have enough. They brought too many women for the number of beds they had. And I said, and there was another room in the city. And I said, well, I got 2 beds down here in my room, and I'm willing to share my room. Well, I think I had other ideas than they had, but they sent 2 of their older contingent down. And I gave them a key, and they would sneak down the back stairwell and at night. And I told them, I said, now, I snore. And this one little old lady who's now dead, but she gave me a wad of cotton after she stayed there, and she said, this and a serenity prayer got me through your snoring. But needless to say, the lady I met on that plane is sitting over here today. Camille, would you stand up? Where is she? There she is. Come June, we'll be married 12 years. When we first met, we carried on a long-distance relationship for several years. I was in Louisville, and she was in Denver. And I was doing a lot of traveling at the time, and I just, everywhere I had to go, planes went through Denver. And so after a couple of years, we were dating, and we became friends. And we became friends before we became lovers. And that was unusual. Today, Camille's my best friend. And after she had gone back to school and was in Colorado, and she was learning how to, she was taking a master's in equine management, which is horses. So she came out to Louisville and was talking with a horse veterinarian. Speaking of horses, just coming from Louisville, and the Derby was just recently, I need to tell you all that Charismatic is an Alla horse. And if you don't know what an Alla horse is, it's the same thing. It's all of his friends and relatives are alcoholics. Not the horses, the trainers and the jockeys. But she came out to Louisville and was offered a job, and she said, as working with a veterinarian, and so she said, came back and told me about this, and she said, well, I don't know whether I should take this job or not. And I said, well, that's easy. I said, take the job and come live with me. And she said, no, I lived with a man for 8 years, and I made up my mind I was never going to live with a man again unless I married him. And I said, well, I've been married to two alcoholics. I'm not about to take on a third. So we compromised and got married. And that's been an adventure. And this program and this way of living is an adventure. When we got married in the foothills in Denver, and everybody who came to the wedding was in the program, even the minister who married us. Everybody was in the program. And it just seemed to be a part of our lives. And it's been continually going that way. We live as a day at a time. I've come to understand that all I have is today. You know, if you ever go into a cemetery, and you look at the headstones, and he'll give the name of the deceased, and he'll give two dates. He'll give the date of birth and date of death. And there's a gap in there about 3 inches, you know, between the two. That's your whole life. And if you stop to think about that, that's all you have. And so you better live one day at a time. You better live today and accept everything that's available to you today. If you worry about yesterday, you get a lot of guilt. And if you worry about tomorrow, you get a lot of fear. And guilt and fear are two things I don't handle too well. So I try to stay in today. And on each day, as I begin my day, I get down on my knees and I pray to my God that after I go through the things I'm doing, I say that third step prayer and I turn my life and my will over to my God, and I say, whatever's out there today, God, give me the courage to do it and the strength to follow thy will, not my will. And then I think, in the words of Helen Keller, you know, life's either got to be a joyous adventure or it's nothing. And my life today is a glorious adventure. I look forward. I don't know what's happening on a day-to-day basis. I just show up and do the next right thing. And all of these things that we do sometimes are just creating insurance. When things are all right, then we're creating insurance for the day when things aren't all right. And the last 6 months in my life have been kind of hard. And starting about my wife is in the middle of writing her doctoral thesis. And being a good alcoholic, even though she's 27 years sober, she has become obsessed with writing her dissertation. And so night and day she works at this. And this spring I found myself, in the morning I'd ask her, I said, well, when are you coming home tonight? And she said, oh, I don't know. Early to her meant like 10, 11 o'clock. And she had an office down at the university, and so she wouldn't be coming home, and at 10 o'clock I'd start going to the window. And I'd do you ever play car? We all, you know. And I was taken back. I'm having a slip here. I'm start counting cars, and I'm start saying, God, let her be here. Five more cars and let her be here. And I try to go to sleep, and I couldn't go to sleep, and I'd pray some more, and then I'd call her up on the telephone. I said, "When are you coming home?" And she says, "Oh, well, don't worry about it. I'm right in the middle of this, and I may be a couple hours, I may be all night." And I says, "Well, you can't get anything done staying up all night." And she would pull these all-nighters, and I would just have a real bad time of it. I'd wake up, and I'd pace the floor. And so I start talking to my sponsor about this, and he said, "Well, you're having a major slip." And he reminded me, he says, "Go read The Dilemma of the Alcoholic Marriage." And I had that book. In fact, I got two copies of this book in my bookshelf. And I reread it a couple of times. You can read this in a couple of hours. And the thing that struck me, in the back of the book, there's the steps and how they apply to the alcoholic marriage. And I read with step three, you know, we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand Him. And it goes on to say, "Am I ready to make this decision to let go and let God take a hand in managing my life? Am I ready to keep hands-off situations created by others no matter what happens? Or will I try to intercept each problem and try to handle it myself? Do I understand that I am turning over to the care of God only my own life and will, and only my own problems, nobody else? Will I try to express His will in all my actions and words towards others, and particularly toward the alcoholic whose sufferings I cannot understand or share?" And that's basic. Basic in our relationship with the alcoholic, and basic in the working of our program. And we also need to just for a moment, keep in mind, you know, we have tools, we have the program, we have meetings, we have sponsorship, and we have the steps and the traditions, and to me, the most important part of the program is the steps. We have the triangle, and we have in that triangle, we have the program, we have the fellowship, but we also have the steps. And to me, that's very important, because in that, you go from that first step and you accept the fact that you're powerless. But the thing that's important in that first step is the second part of that step, which says, "And our life is unmanageable." I've come to understand that the unmanageability of my life is a permanent thing, and that my life will always be unmanageable. And so I hate to see people come into the program and they get a little relief and they leave. I want the serenity. I want everything. I'm like the mad dog alcoholic. I want to enjoy everything in life. And the only way I can enjoy my life is to keep serene, to keep the serenity. And my life is never going to be manageable. But it's okay, because we have that second step. And the second step, that there's a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sanity. And I've come to understand that, to me, my higher power is God. It can be a telephone pole, it can be a meeting, it can be your sponsor, but for me, my higher power is my God, and that gives me the hope that my life's going to be okay. And coupled with that, with the third step prayer, and the third step, turning our life and will over to care of God as we understand it, I know I'm going to be okay if I do that on a daily basis. And on a daily basis, I accept the fact that I'm powerless, I acknowledge my God, and I turn my life and will over to Him. I make that commitment, not just once, but every day. And as long as I continue to do that, we call that the Al-Anon Waltz, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And I remember that, and I do that on a daily basis. Certainly I do go on from that, and I work, do my inventories and share those in the fifth step. And I know the six and seven, we humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings. And that six and seven step are very important, because it's a surrender to God. It's a surrender and win situation. It's not a surrender and lose. And so often we think humility is equal to humiliation. It's two different things. And you humbly turn your life and your will over to God, and you go on to making your amends. And that's where the freedom comes. The real freedom comes in doing the amends. And as I said earlier, don't do it anymore. Make your amends. Unlock the keys of your jail and get on. Because the real real freedom comes in getting rid of all of these resentments and angers and things that block us from our higher power. And you get to the point where you have to make a few amends, and if you're making amends, you're doing it on a daily basis and getting clear, and that's the 10th step. And you make that, and you're persistent. You do that 10th step on a daily basis, and then you get into 11, to me, which is the greatest step of them all, which is the spirituality of this program. And all of you are, through all of you, God speaks to me. You are like His angels. And it's only through people that I believe that God speaks to me, and therefore I need you. And that takes me to the 12th step, which I call selflessness. Because the nature of the illness in both the drinker and the non-drinker is that we're selfish. And so we get beyond the selfishness of our lives and get into unselfishness, we begin to understand that how the program works, and we carry that message to others. That's the only change. Beside us is the 12 steps of AA, and there's only one word that's different, and that's we carry the message to others, where the AAs carry it to the alcoholics. It's only about 250 words in those 12 steps, and you can take those to your head much faster than you can take it to your heart. But I would ask all of you, if you're going to work this program, take those 12 steps to your heart. I'd like to finish by reading a poem that I found. It's called God. It says, God is like Coke. He's the real thing. God is like Bear aspirin. He works wonders. God is like Hallmark cards. He cares enough to send the very best. God is like VO hairspray. He works in all kinds of weather. God is like Dial soap. Aren't you glad you know Him? Don't you wish everyone would? God is like Scotch tape. You can't see Him, but you know He's there. God is like an American Express card. Don't leave home without Him. Again, thank you so much. Thank you so much, and I wish for you all of the great things in life, all of the peace and the joy and the happiness that this program brings, but most of all, I wish for you a real desire to work this program, to make it a part of your life. And if nobody has told you today they love you, I love you. Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.